Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Gather Round. It's another great evening tonight, and, oh, you don't recognize my voice. Well, this is Michael from 30 Minutes, and this evening we are turning the tables on Ruth Ann, and she is the guest on Gather Round. Ruth Ann, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. This feels a little different. Good, but different.
Well, are you ready to dive into this so our listeners can learn a little bit more about yourself?
I am.
Okay, well.
Oh, first of all, I want to say I'm getting some feedback.
Oh. Well, I'm not really sure what I can do to change that.
Okay, you're not on
I'm not on any kind of speaker thing or whatever.
Okay, then we'll just forge ahead.
Okay, I'll do the best I can. So put on your sort of your personal time machine. We're going to go back into your history a little bit. And I was wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit about what it was like to be a practicing pagan during your earliest days in Chicago.
Oh, it was wonderful. The earliest days there, because it was pretty open. There were so many people doing so many things, and I had the best teachers ever. And so it was really, really nice. We were organized. We did new moons every month at different venues, but basically a couple churches we rented space from, and it was good. There seemed like there was a lot of sense of community.
Mm-hmm. How did that work, doing pagan rituals in churches?
Actually, very well. you know, because there's plenty of room. I mean, we would rent the basement. Actually, mm-hmm. The one I remember real well was a place that after we would leave, we would have to be out by 10, so we started at 8, because they provided a shelter for the homeless there.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew what we did. There was no
sneaking
around, no secrets, and they knew that we were a spiritual group, and that seemed fine with them. The only time we got in trouble was somebody went and they rented space at a performance art building,
mm-hmm.
and they did not come out with the truth, okay?
Mm.
They said that we were some kind of performance artists and blah, 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 and they put down money, and money was hard to come by, but we had it. They put down the money for the rent for 2 months at this place. It was a pretty place, a nice location, and for the first time, or the first ritual we did, a couple people from the organization that we were renting from showed up to look it over.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no way. So we were lied to.
And
so we didn't get to go back the next month or get our money back. But it was really, that was just because the people who had rented it, those couple people, they did not. I mean, they beat around the bush instead of coming out and saying, we're pagans. We do these new moon rituals, or we do this festivals, you know, 8 times a year, and we'd like to do one at your location. So, you know, it was one of those things. I hope that people learned from it.
Absolutely. Can you tell us anything about some of the particular people who stand out in your mind from that period who were particularly inspiring or instrumental in your development as a pagan?
Phaedra Bonowitz. Chris Heyman is her name. She definitely was. She was my first teacher.
Uh-huh.
And,
wow.
And her teacher, Althea Orr.
Althea, I've heard of, yes.
Right. She runs a business in Chicago, body work and herbs and things. And so they were there, Phaedra's partner at the time, Joseph Kenny, and Althea's husband, who has since died, John. They were very much part of that formative time for me. There were many, though. Krista Landon, who is a minister in Minnesota, I believe now, and her husband, Tom. And just so many people who were part of the group for a while, and they would move on, and there would be more people come. Because we did so much that was open. Mm-hmm. With Phaedra and Althea and their husbands, a couple other people, myself, we did a lot of closed work. And in fact, several of us had moved in to a wonderful house together.
Oh, wow.
That, it was nice. It was on the north side. And it was a good idea. But, you know, you have to have something besides the spirituality in common to really live with people. it's hard. A lot of things, like not enough had been worked out ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended very badly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't regret it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of lessons learned. But I know now when people talk about living with others and, you know, well, we've got this in common, so we'll all move in together. And it's like, whoa, you know, pull back. You really need to go over a lot of other things before you move in with people.
Absolutely. And this is true in any situation.
yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It actually, though, it was one of those good things that accelerated the growth of all of us. So I can't, you know, say, oh, I wish it never would have happened.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of Akasha Temple?
Yeah, well, it was actually this experience living in this house that we started out because we were all initiates. We were all priests and priestesses. And in fact, one of my friends who's in Santa Maria had moved in with us. And so, you know, we called it the Abbey, and the people in the pagan community there at the time called it the Abbey. I mean, you know, what else are you going to call them? Places, all these priests and priestesses. However, by the time we left, we were calling it Hell House. And so my partner, Michael, and I at the time, we were talking with another friend of ours, Michael Jackson, not the one that is real famous. And we decided, well, we weren't going to let this, you know, go to waste, so we would just start our own group. And somewhere I had seen the word Akasha, and I loved it because it means beyond time and space. Mm-hmm. So it's basically boundaryless. And so we just said, okay, Akasha Temple it is. That was how it came to be.
What are some of the, can you tell us a little bit how in some of the ways that Akasha Temple has sort of evolved from its earliest days and then over the years? Because I know there was, there was the Akasha Temple that I worked with you in, and then there was the temple by the lake for a while, and then, you know, and now it's the name of a radio show. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, the temple of the lake was not Akasha. That was just more of a name for a broader base. But Akasha, after Michael left, Bill Urbacher was one of our people, and he became the high priest of Akasha, and that was for a while. I've moved a bit around here and there. And when I left and was just going back for either the eight festivals or a full moon or a new moon or whatever, about that time he got a little ill too. And so things were just sort of sliding. I moved away from the city. Mm-hmm. And was doing some things. I had students in, I moved to Kankakee, Illinois, and I had students there. And one of them became a priest and had his second degree and then his third degree. And so that is my brother, Casey Carraher, who is the high priest of Akash Temple. But we have grown past the high priest, high priestess thing. We don't invoke those or use those names much at all.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine recently was Googling, and he had to have gone way back to, I don't know. I mean, he was describing some pictures, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, they're like 8 years old, and I don't look like that. Casey doesn't look like that. are you Lady Ruthann? And I said, well, yeah, but I don't use that. But so we've come away from more of that structure.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually work with several people, but we don't do things like we did when Casey and I lived in Kankakee.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're each about an hour away from there in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
When we get together, we do things, and people join us. Who some are from way back, and then others are not from that far back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
mm-hmm.
totally changed, and we just do a lot of our what do you want to call it, like pagan socializing, actually on Akasha Temple Radio.
Mm-hmm. Back going again in those early days in Chicago when I got involved with Akasha Temple. The pagan community seemed very prolific. Once again, as you stated, very open, not just to Akasha Temple, but there were many groups practicing around Chicago. There were newsletters where you could find out about the various groups. Mm-hmm. I found out about Akasha Temple through one of those newsletters. What is your impressions of why the pagan community was so prolific at that time versus, I don't know, about 10 years or so down the road, it's almost like it sort of went underground a little bit.
I think it did, and I do not know why. Over the years and around the country, I've met people who actually like to be a part of that underground, persecuted kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but I've been very disappointed just to see that there's not much to see. If you go into, well, now one thing that happened, though, that was sad and might have something to do with it, a lot of the bookstores, New Age, pagan, whatever, occult stores closed.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that's due to being able to buy so much, not only books, but supplies online. Mm-hmm. And so we used to have like bookstores as our stable cornerstones. We could meet there for little of nothing, or maybe, you know, 10, 20 bucks. The ones that were large enough to have a room where we could do meetings and different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we supported them, obviously not enough to keep them in business. You know, a lot of individual stores have gone down with the way the economy is now. So I think that's one of the reasons. But it is disappointing to see that. Now, there's still Pagan Pride. It's not even in Chicago anymore. It's in Oak Park.
It's not? Oh. It's
in a burb. Because the people that run it with the copyright, supposedly, well, I know it's true, you can't have two Pagan Prides within a certain distance. They have to be far enough apart. So that means you can't have one in Chicago and the burbs. So the people who are running it have gotten, in the burbs have gotten, you know, this pretty much sewn up, it seems. So Chicago Pagan Pride is not in Chicago.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, but they still
have... they still call it Chicago Pagan Pride, even though it's not in Chicago?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's the name, yeah. But they do have that every year. And Matt Williams, who you may remember, he does moments of mindfulness on Akasha Temple Radio. He was there, and he reports back to us about, you know, this is his second year there, and he really enjoys it. He did a lot of readings and things there this year. But so Pagan Pride is still thriving. But I really don't know of much else. There's a group of people in the southern suburbs that meet every month for dinner. So they keep in touch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you participate in some of the large-scale community events around the country, like Starwood and so forth. Are those still very active pagan gatherings?
Oh, my God. Starwood. I mean, you said the magic word. My heart just started beating faster. That is my festival. I didn't go for a few years. We had gone several times when it was in Western New York, but then it is moved to Southeastern Ohio. A lovely venue, beautiful, 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 Wisteria. It's right outside of Pomeroy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't have the number of people yet, but they're growing. Like this year, there were more than last year. Next year, there will be more.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just one of those. Now, they don't build themselves just as pagan either. I mean, they're just very alternative. They're headquartered, ACE is out of Cleveland, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And they do like, they're doing something there for winter solstice. A friend of ours who heads up the band, Morticia's Chair, he was telling us the other night, you know, that they'll be going to that. But it's a lot of the Starwood people. We were in Cleveland a few weeks ago for a party that Morticia's Chair threw, and it was so nice because one of the men from Starwood that we met and who heads up the radio business at Starwood was there, and it's like such a, and he's not from Cleveland either, but it's just such a small world, really. So that was nice. But no, Starwood has my heart. I've gone years when I didn't present, and I've gone years when I did, and it
mm-hmm.
doesn't matter. I just love it.
So you say it's not just pagan, most more alternative. Can you mention some of the other, I don't know, groups or organizations that participate, or something that somebody might encounter were they to go?
There's performance art there.
Okay.
And that isn't really pagan. I mean, you know, when I say, and I'm using pagan as a broad term, some of the people wouldn't possibly describe themselves as pagan. They're
yes.
certainly not Wiccan, but
mm-hmm.
Harvey Wasserman, people may have heard of him. He's very big on solar energy and has written a book called Solartopia.
Okay.
He's into politics. He has his own radio show, not Blog Talk, but someplace else. And I've listened to some. He is always there, and he speaks. Oberon Zell, who is definitely pagan, is always there.
He
speaks. Ariel Montserrat, who is the editor-publisher of Green Egg Magazine. Now, she did not do a workshop this year, but they are there.
So are they still publishing?
Pardon?
Is Green Egg still publishing?
Online.
Oh, okay.
It's a zine, totally. But it's real good. GreenEggZine.com. So, yeah. There's a lot of people who just, from different, I can't think of his name, Reverend Bob, who's, oh my goodness, some kind of total Discordian kind of person is there. There's a lot of the ADF, the Druids.
So there's
a lot of different people, but then just some people who like to come and be around people who are open.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And there's a lot of smart people there.
Mm-hmm.
basically, you know, there, and of course there will be a few conversations here and there that are just light and, you know, I mean, just keeps the things spinning, but it's pretty hard not to, you know, sit down with somebody and not within 5 or 10 minutes get into a deeper conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us, depending on where we live, we're starved for that. So it's a real good thing for us.
Are there folks there who say follow alternative, or not alternative, it's not quite the right word, but follow, you know, particular, alternative health, alternative health is important to them. Like maybe they're into energy work, or maybe they're into herbs, or a vegan diet, so forth.
All of those.
Okay.
There were workshops on solar energy, particularly, and there were different workshops on the herbs. I know one of the people with us went to some of those. I did some I did one on veganism. There's just about everything
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you can think of. There's a gay, lesbian, LGBT group with meetups and things. I shouldn't say meetups, but, you know, a lunch or something like that. There's going to be a tea this coming year, I know, because Casey and a couple people are planning it. So there's a lot of different things like that. There's always the poly people. You know, I mean, we're everywhere. And so there's good workshops on polyamory.
Oh, wow.
So pretty much anything that, you know, comes
anything
around.
Right. Anything that can be considered alternative, I guess, from the mainstream, whether it be spirituality or just invention.
Right. Yeah. Lifestyle. Yeah. Now, these festivals are clothing optional.
Mm-hmm.
And because this is private property, and I know some festivals around the country can't be clothing optional because they are maybe rented from the forest department of something or other, you know, a government place, the Forest Service, yeah. But this land was bought and reclaimed. Actually, this is an old mining area, and it's been replanted. Wonderful trees, there's ravines, it's up and down, and there's quite a bit of nature actually to enjoy, and it's, you know, diverse, and there's a pond and everything.
Oh, that's wonderful that they've sort of revitalized the area.
Yeah.
Well, talking a little bit about, since we brought up veganism, you've been following a vegan diet for many years, and prior to that, you followed a very strict vegetarian diet. Can you talk a little bit about when you made, when you became perhaps a vegetarian and then made the transition to veganism and kind of why behind it all?
Well, I made the decision to become a vegetarian when I was running a natural food store. And I was reading the magazines,
mm-hmm.
and it was like, okay, this is very plain. And because I had that disconnect like a lot of people did, I thought, like the animals didn't feel pain or what, I don't know, because I've always had animals myself,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, living with me, and there was just such a big disconnect. But I did it originally for the ethics. I didn't want to take part in animal abuse and animal murder.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like a lot of people, I would still eat crap. It just didn't have animals in it.
Right.
And for quite a while, I ate the eggs that were supposedly from, you know, cage-free hens.
Right.
But then I saw that means nothing. There's 80,000 chickens in this big building with like three little doors spaced out, and they're about 18-inch square, so they can go out into the yard if they can find the door.
It was
horrible. And then we know that any that actually have met a rooster or any chicks that are born, you know, in these, when they're breeding them, then the boys are just thrown in a grinder alive, the male chicks. And, I mean, you know, it's just horrible. They cut their beaks and trim their wings and pump them full of shots, put them in this thing with other chickens that they can't even barely turn around in. You know, I mean, there's so much. And so the ethical reason was mine. But then I stopped the eggs, and I was still doing a bit of cream, half and half, in coffee, which I liked. But my basic thing was to put it in coffee that I'm a coffee snob, and the coffee that wasn't good, if I would be somewhere, I wanted to put cream in it. But then, you know, I had that talk with myself. Why am I drinking this shit? If I like it, why am I trying to, you know, cover up the taste?
Right.
So the cream was going, and the cheese, I have read and talked with people, cheese has been the hardest thing for people, and that has held people back from becoming vegan, because we do like cheese, but it's an addiction. But once I made up my mind, I don't miss it. I just I have it. And one time I did buy one of those packs of, like, fake cheese, because I was going to make something that I had always made with cheese. I don't think I'll do that again. I shouldn't say I never will. But, you know, when you read the ingredients and all these things like that, just because it doesn't have animal products doesn't mean it's good for you. There's
absolutely
a lot of bad stuff in there. So it's something I sure wouldn't make a habit of. And I just don't miss it. And I think, like you, I've gone so far over into raw. I'm not as raw as you are. But I'm pretty raw, and I don't think I'm ever, I would never say that I will go 100% raw, because I still like drinking tea, and I still like coffee, not like I used to, but some. But I eat a lot of raw. It's good for me.
Absolutely.
And, you know, unfortunately,
I'm not there 100% either, and I do still, I'm still a little bit on the cheese thing myself, but I'm finding myself, you know, I'm cutting it back more and more, and I'm finding, like you say yourself, I don't really miss it.
Yeah.
But there are, like, I have a little bit in the refrigerator, and I'm sure I will use that up. You know, I won't just throw it away, because I don't believe in throwing food away either.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, and then there's a book called The Uncheese, which I got years ago. Funny. I've never made anything from it, but it actually, it has some recipes that aren't harmful, basically, but to make something that might make you think or have the texture or something of it, maybe a cream cheese or a different kind of cheese. And, you know, they always use yeast in them, you know, good nutritional yeast, which gives it sort of a cheesy flavor kind of thing. So I may do something from that one of these days. But I'm really not missing it.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, pizza is really good with just tomato sauce and veggies.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's quite a few places that have been making cheeseless pizzas for people that are especially lactose intolerant. I mean, they weren't thinking it from a vegan standpoint, but still, it's definitely been available out there. So we should all give it a try.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Sort of changing gears a little bit again and going back to radio, at what point, while you were working with Casey on Radio Akasha, did you come to the decision to form Air Amartipio?
I had been thinking about it for a while. Now, we've been doing Akasha Temple Radio for 2 years. Actually, 2 years, the end of this month. We started on Christmas Day. I think that was either that was our first show or that was our trial or something, but anyway, it's right around Christmas. And there's a lot of things that I want to explore that are not, they have nothing to do with paganism. And while I did bring in a lot of people on Akasha Temple Live that weren't pagan for interviews and things with, you know, topics that would be of interest to pagans, but still, I thought, you know, I really want to just branch out and not have to have some tie-in with paganism. I mean, the tie-in is me because I'm pagan, but, you know, I have other interests. And so I was thinking about it, and there's so much going on in the world, as you know, politically and not just politically, but other things, that I thought, well, you know, if I do this myself and I can have some people in doing things that I believe in, I don't have to do it myself. But, you know, and that's like you interview people across the board, however, you know, whoever you want, and you're going to change it up a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm a socialist. I've got Stuart Alexander doing a socialist show. You know, so, I mean, it was just an opportunity to get more out there.
Definitely. Can you tell us a little bit about how your own political views have changed about not only politics, but also media, saying from the time of, you know, just before 9/11 to today?
Oh, my God. We're definitely talking 180. you know, because, well, I grew up in a small town. My parents had a grocery store, and they worked very hard, and we never had tons of money. But, you know, the capitalist system was the only one I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been brought up from school, you know, to think that, well, okay, you know, you work, you get this. If people don't work, they don't. But, you know, somebody will take care of them. They'll, you know, I mean, I never, because I was brought up in a church, and I never thought that there was anything wrong with helping people. But 9/11 probably was the thing that brought out questions. And at first, I just swallowed it, just totally, like a lot of other Americans. And, you know, since then, I found out that people around the world knew better, but it was the Americans that were so slow. You know, I did not want to think that my government would have anything to do with this. And it took me quite a while. I mean, different people were saying, well, you know, maybe you should think about this or that. And I was just so blinded. I just couldn't face it. Once I did, everything fell into place. It was like, okay. So then I find out about the USS Liberty, you know, way, way back in the 60s. And, you know, so many things that weren't. And I had always heard that FDR knew about Pearl Harbor before it happened, but I hadn't been aware that he did everything he could do. Like there's seven or eight things of provocation. I mean, he did all of these things to make sure that Japan attacked. And, you know, just all of this history that I had been lied to and lied to and lied to. So then, you know, I started checking into and seeing, really opening my eyes and seeing capitalism is really evil. I mean, if you're in the upper percentage, whatever, and you're making your money off the sweat of other people, you know, you don't think it's so evil. But, you know, the foundations of your wealth is built on very unhappy, very unwell, in many ways, people.
Mm-hmm.
So when it all just started coming together, I started learning more and more about, you know, the dirty words. Where I grew up and when I grew up, socialism and communism were the dirty words.
Mm-hmm.
They were four-letter words. And when I found out that they're not four-letter words, I started meeting people. It was just like, okay, so I'm a socialist. Okay. okay, there we go. And so I've actually, you know, talked to somebody who is close to me. I said, does that bother you? Because he's pretty apolitical, except very pro-Palestinian, anti-Zio, you know, kind of thing. He said, absolutely not. I said, well, that's good, because, I mean, it's not that I would change, but, you know, I want you to know up front that I'm not, like, voting Republican or Democrat, you know, that kind of thing. So, no, it's been a journey, and it's been a great one, though. I've learned a lot. And about myself.
What do you think you've learned about yourself through this process?
that I'm actually probably a better person than I might have thought. I mean, I always thought I was probably fairly kind and all. But then when I see what the people who subscribe to capitalism are doing, and even very poor people that would still vote for the capitalist system, because they're, again, they're like I was. I think I've learned some patience, even though, I mean, you may hear me sometimes when my patience has run out, but I do. I mean, I know where they're coming from. I used to have my head up my ass also. So I try to be more patient with them, but just try to point things out. And since things are moving faster now, it's easier because people see what's happening. And they like these programs we have. You know, they like having a fire department. They like having roads. Well, this is part of socialism. And you pointed out, like a friend of mine had said, well, I wish you guys would use a different word. I thought, well, you know, I mean, no, we're not, we don't need to use a different word. We just need to make sure people understand what socialism really is.
Need to get past the propaganda and get at the truth.
Yes.
You've become very very active and passionate about the situation in Palestine. Can you talk a little bit about that, where that began for you, where you became aware of that situation, and why you've become so active?
You know, I just keep almost apologizing. I am apologizing for my blindedness for so long. And I would hear now, I was, for years, for whatever reason, I was a fan, for want of a better word, of Arafat. Because I thought, you know, this man, he has a point, his land, his people. But I never really got into it that deep. And I was aware, well, probably for several years now, I've been aware, but and I knew that this country, the U.S., was behaving dreadfully. But the final straw for me, it wasn't way back when Rachel Corrie was murdered, like several of my friends jumped on right then, not me. I had... My final straw with this government was the Mavi Marmara in May of 2010, when the Israelis murdered 9 people on these ships, on the aid ship. One of them actually was a dual citizen, a young man who had Turkish and U.S. citizenship. And the U.S. did absolutely nothing. And they did nothing. This happened way out in international waters. And the U.S. did nothing but support Israel. And it was such a, it was just like, okay, well, that is the final straw. But before that, no, I had been just aware for a little while, but I think that that was just the final thing. It's like, well, this definitely has to end. And then you know, I found out about Occupied Kashmir. And it's like, wow, you know, there's a lot of places that are going through this.
There's a lot of oppression in the world today.
And the United States is a major player in a
behind a great deal of it.
In Africa now, there, you know, because they found more rare earth minerals and different things. I mean, there's oil. There's all these natural resources that multinational companies want to come in and steal. So, of course, the U.S. is right there on top of things. And, you know, water is going to be one of the biggies coming up. So I every time I think about that, I just think, okay, people can fight that. The people in Bolivia did. And when an outside company was going to, an outside U.S. company was going to, you know, take over their water rights, they fought it and they won. It can be done. So I never want people to think, well, we're just a little country or we're not very strong, we can't do it.
How do you feel about being an American, knowing what you now know about the way the American government operates?
Sick at my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Very ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's, and don't get me wrong, because as you know, there's wonderful people in this country. We do
Absolutely.
Have wonderful people. It's a beautiful country. It's big. We've got all kinds of things. I mean, from the mountains, you know, to, oh, the Great Lakes, the desert, the Gulf, that both oceans. I mean, we have a beautiful country, and I love it. And I do get frustrated when I think very long about how did we, all these wonderful people, give up so much power to this uniparty that rules us?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the answer. I think that, but, you know, propaganda, media, a lot of the dumbing down, the sitting on dead asses in front of the TV, that's how a lot of it came about.
what do you think about sort of the whole political system in America, the whole idea of you know, having these elections to vote for these people to supposedly represent our interests. Is that system working, in your opinion?
Definitely it's not working. There's a lot of things we need to get rid of and change. One thing is we need to take the money out. We need to dump the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have instant runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who's running needs to be debating.
Absolutely. And
so there's a lot that needs to be changed. That was why I wanted people to go ahead and vote third party this time. I mean, none of us are stupid enough to think that on a national level any third party person is going to win. But, you know, if we can garner numbers, that shows that we're not just falling for the same old shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's going to take a while to have a peaceful changeover, or there's going to be a big, abrupt change.
Mm-hmm. Like another American Revolution?
Yeah. So, we're, you know, it's just interesting to see which way it goes.
Are you inspired by the things that are happening, say, for instance, in Egypt, or disturbed by that?
Both. I'm disturbed because of the part that the U.S. is playing.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I'm very inspired.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inspired every day by people who are marching or whatever they're doing. I mean, going into a situation where they know they're going to have tear gas at the least thrown at them, and they may be shot with rubber bullets and things, but they keep doing it. And it's so inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get frustrated and I have to go away from the computer and, you know, go take a walk and do whatever. But then it's like, okay, you know, get yourself together here. I mean, you know, these people are on the ground and they keep doing it. So, you know, I have found so much inspiration in the last few years. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the human race is evolving to a higher state of being, as is being talked about in spiritual circles?
Most definitely. And doesn't that sound weird with everything that's going on? But what's going on in the world, I think, is the dying throes of this terrible system that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And just the vibratory level of people is raising. People who, you know, a couple of years ago wouldn't even be able to say spiritual, much less spell it. you know, now you say certain things to them, man, they're so on board. They understand. Or they'll say, well, you know, it seems to me like this and this is happening. And it's like, yeah, okay, they're getting it. So I do think that people are evolving. And it's just that sometimes I have to remind myself or, you know, go to a certain place to remind myself because I see so much of the other. But when I then say, okay, well, dying throes, you know, sometimes people right before the fall, they get really busy. And that's how I feel about what's going on in the world.
Today is 12-12-12, and last year we had 11-11-11. Today's triple-digit date is the last time we will ever see a triple-digit date, if you think about it, because there is no 13th month or anything beyond that. So unless we go to a new calendar system, this is it. Do unusual number sequences like this hold any significance for you personally, or do you experience seeing number sequences?
I don't work with numbers very much, no. I mean, I like it, you know, I thought, oh, 12, 12, 12. And a lot of people probably put more emphasis on it. But for me personally, no. It's just, you know, the whole December 21st thing that people are worrying about, you know, that supposedly started October 28th, 2011.
Right.
The date, you know, so that kind of thing. I mean, it just depends on who you want to talk to. And, you know, the Mayan calendar doesn't end because in some of their writings, they talk about things in 3,000 this or 3,000 that.
Right.
So, you know, people have just so misinterpreted these things. But I do think that we've been going through this change now for a while. And I mean, whatever you want to call it. If you want to call it the Age of Aquarius, whatever. But the transformation has begun some time ago, and it's speeding up, though.
Yeah, definitely. What would you say that you are most passionate about? What is it that is your driving force? What keeps you going?
Truth. And the lack of it in this country. So getting truth out to people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, because I think that, you know, we can deal with things, but we need to know facts. We need to know the truth. Because it's very sad to see people like building on some false foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that our media, particularly in this country, has so let us down when it comes to truth. I mean, it's a joke. All of our major media is owned by about 6 companies,
mm-hmm.
and they're told what to say. And so, you know, you rarely get a major media figure who comes out. I mean, if they're not supporting themselves, I mean, if they're working for a company, the ones who come out and talk, you know, they're pretty much bound as to what they say.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know if you look closely at any news commentator, they all have those little earphones in their ear. And trust me, they're not there for, you know, Muzak or anything.
Right, right. It's like, oh, don't go there, back off, can't say that.
Say this.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's unfortunate. And that's one of the reasons why I think that the alternative media, the newspapers, I'm telling you, there's a couple of the Worldwide Hippie paper, my friend Joe runs, Salem-News, Tim King and Bonnie King run. Now, these are real papers with real citizen journalists at work. World is Watching, it's another one. You know, there's real papers with people who are not paid. They're telling it like they see it, like it's happening, and mm-hmm. we need to support them. And a lot of Blog Talk radio stations are that way too. So, mm-hmm. you know, nobody's getting rich on them.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that are coming up for you in the new year? Anything new and exciting, or maybe some things that are coming up on Air Emetopia or Radio Akasha?
Well, a couple things. I'm trying now back with Radio Akasha, Akasha Temple Radio show, to probably just do more pagans, because now that I have the other outlet for mm-hmm. other things. So, actually, you are being interviewed tomorrow night on Akasha Temple Live.
Right.
And then Kenny Klein is being interviewed Sunday. He's a fiddler, a musician man from New Orleans, who we've met at Starwood. Friday night on Feed Your Head on Air Marte Fio, Robbie Martin from Dublin is on with From Ireland to Palestine. He's a major activist, and the Irish have been so good to and for Palestine, and he's going to explain why, you know, that happened. But and I've got another project coming up, but I can't talk much about it because in the next couple months there'll be more about
okay,
it.
Okay, no worries.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was just invited to be part of something, and on 12/12/12, as a matter of fact.
Today, oh, really?
Yeah. Right out of, for me, just right out of the clear blue sky, it's like, wow, yeah, I want to be part of this. So, yeah, you know, there's things coming up. I hope to take a trip this year. And you'll know more about that as it comes closer to. But a lot of this people, just getting to know more people, putting them on the air, learning from them, meeting people in person and you know, online, on Skype, whatever. We're so blessed to have all this technology that I don't understand. you know. So I think it's going to be a good year for me personally, and actually for the world. I think that there's going to be more understanding. I think that's what's going to happen with this higher vibratory rate,
mm-hmm.
that people are going to just understand more. And if that just means they understand themselves, that's okay, because by understanding yourself, you start to understand the other people too.
Absolutely. So do you think that we are living, in a sense, in a smaller world than the world we used to live in?
Oh, much smaller. Much smaller. You know, it used to take, what, months to maybe get a letter, you know, halfway around the world?
Right.
And now we're online, and if this person doesn't reply to us in 2 seconds, we'd get all pissy. I mean, it's like, okay, yeah. It's like, what do you mean? What took you so long? You know, what, 5 minutes? Or, you know, what? Oh, okay, you had to go get something to drink. Okay, but, you know, it's, yeah. And it, I mean, I don't know now what we would do without it. It doesn't, I think that we're having to learn more back to understanding, because we can just say what pops into our head now,
mm-hmm.
and that's not always the best thing.
Right.
Depending on who we're talking to or what we're talking about.
So mm-hmm.
sometimes we need to think. You know, when you used to, like, write letters, you'd have the letter, you'd be writing it for, you know, maybe that day, the next day. You wouldn't mail it for a couple of days. You'd be able mm-hmm. to go back and see, well, should I maybe just rewrite this and not put that in there?
Right.
Because, you know, your feelings changed a little bit. But now, with email, but especially now with, like, personal messaging and things, it's like whatever comes out, comes out.
Right.
So maybe we should just take our time on that.
Yes. Give it a little perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been reading anything interesting lately that you could share with our listeners?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I go back and forth.
Even online, you know.
Well, yeah, I do read online. But, you know, there's a couple books that Uspensky wrote, In Search of the Miraculous and The Fourth Way. And I get into those when I want to totally get away from things. The person who started Akasha Temple with me was a big fan of Uspensky and mm-hmm. introduced me to this fantastic mystic. So, you know, he was a student of Gurdjieff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, if I want to really get totally away, otherwise, if I want something just to clear my head, I love detectives and mystery stories. And so I'll just pick up something like that and figure out, okay, who did it and why. And okay, and then I'm good to come back. You know, it's one of those outlets for frustration.
Yeah.
You know me, anything that's around that's handy, I will read.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to go through my books, these thousands and thousands, and it's like, oh my God, because I don't need them all. But
right.
yet, I'm one of those people. My Buddhist training in non-attachment isn't working so well here because, well, it's like I'm not attached to the book, but I'm attached to where it goes.
Right.
I could just box up a bunch of these books and take them to the multi-agency or up someplace. But I happen to know that a lot of these are really good, and I would like for the quote-unquote right person to get them. And it's
sure.
like, I'm the one who knows, but I don't know. And so the non-attachment, while I love it and I'm good at it in a lot of ways, when it's coming to, you know, winnowing out my books, it's a bit harder. But
that's a hard thing to do.
It is hard, but you are like the master of simplicity when it comes to just wiping out all your material belongings, because you've done that more than once, and I have been in awe when you can do it. The first time you did it, we lived in the same apartment building, and you just started giving away all these things. It's like, my God, Michael, well, I don't want it anymore. I don't need it. It's like, what? You know?
You know, it's funny. A lot of people have talked about that over the years, and I think it's kind of like, the change for you for going from vegetarian to vegan, they're just things that, yes, they had value, but I just don't miss them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's really true. Now, there's a few things I've missed because I've lost all my household, everything, twice in my life. Mm-hmm. And both times I hated the way it happened, and I would have chosen to save some things.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I do have the memories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, it's okay. But I think that's just, yeah, it's funny. But yeah, I'll never forget the first time you did that after I met you. It's like, okay, well, Michael can do this. So here, throw this out.
Well, we only have maybe a minute or so left. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience this evening?
I would just say, you know, don't believe anything you hear or read, truly. Check it out. I mean, of course, there's going to be people that you do believe, and that's okay. But, I mean, just basically, and if you're watching the lamestream media, just remember it's lame, and they're paid to lie. So, you know, check things out. And I would say try to start making friends, if you don't already have them, with people in other countries. And it's very easy now with Facebook. And you can start getting all these different perspectives.
Definitely.
You know, and then we know that really we're all going through the same kind of thing, some people to a greater extent. But most of us are very unhappy with our governments. And mm-hmm. this is what's going to save us, because we're going to have a united front down the road. the people of the world. I firmly believe this.
Absolutely. I believe that too. Ruthann, this has been really wonderful. I hope everyone has enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been funny being in the driver's seat of Gather Round, but I've had a great time. So thank you very much. And
well, thank you. And I wanted to ask people, stay tuned for Half the Sky coming up very shortly. I should say 30 minutes coming up very shortly. Michael is doing part one of Half the Sky review, and this is going to be really good. So, I thank you so much.
Thank you. Evening's broadcast contains graphic and mature content. Viewer discretion is advised.
Good evening. You are listening to 30 Minutes with Michael Staples. This evening, I'm going to talk about an important documentary I viewed recently that will change the way you view women and young girls' issues worldwide. It's called Half the Sky: Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. This is a 4-hour television documentary that was originally made for PBS and international broadcast, shot in 10 countries such as Cambodia, Kenya, India, Sierra Leone, Somaliland, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Liberia, and the U.S. It was inspired by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn's book of the same title. Documentary series introduces women and girls who are living under some of the most difficult circumstances imaginable and fighting bravely to change them. Traveling with intrepid reporter Nicholas Kristof is a group of celebrity advocates such as American Ferrera, Diane Lane, Ava Mendez, Meg Ryan, Gabrielle Union, and Olivia Wilde. The film reflects viable and sustainable options for empowerment and offers an actionable blueprint for transformation. Please listen in as I play excerpts from the film and talk about my own impressions. In this first excerpt, Nicholas Kristof, the person who wrote the book in partnership with his wife Cheryl, talks a little bit about the inspiration behind the film Half the Sky.
Tear gas, rubber bullets, down bombs. Jet itself, the jet we eat are almost mythical. I've been in this business a long time. The idea for Half the Sky really arose many years ago when my wife Cheryl and I were living in China together as reporters for the New York Times.
I was a business reporter. My background is in business, you know, and he was more of a political reporter, so we were very complimentary. We were probably the first couple at the New York Times to work as a mom and pop shop.
We had covered Tiananmen, we covered the Jews being killed there, and then we realized that the greatest human rights abuse in the country was one we hadn't devoted a single column inch to.
These are funny things about the preference for boys that China had. We found that there were 39,000 female babies per year missing. Not a word had been written about them. And then there were some other things about China. There is a saying called Wai Mai Fu Yi, which is the abduction and sale of women. And we thought, wow, that's really weird that there's a special phrase for it. And at the time, we thought it was only in China. It was many, many years later that we saw that this was a phenomenon that went beyond China.
Meet Jackie. She's a 7-year-old girl living in the West African country of Liberia. And like too many Liberian women and girls, she's a victim of rape.
Start uncovering these terrible things that were just being done to women, targeted at women. So he started writing about it. He started pulling on the string.
The more we looked, the more we found. And increasingly, we came to think that the central human rights abuse of our age didn't involve political repression, didn't involve so many other things we focused on, but involved
as they meet with Amy Kande of the Rainbow Center, which is a rape crisis center for women and girls in Sierra Leone.
Really, they're primarily responding to rape, to provide specialized medical treatment and counseling as well. We've seen over 9,000 survivors. Within 8 years. 52% that are between the ages of 12 and 17. Then you have about 26% that are under 12.
Under 12?
Yes.
26% or under
12? That are under 12 years old.
Yes. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. The trend is we see more and more children, about 80% of our clientele. We see an average between 100 to 200 per month. And they are as young as 2.5 months old.
We soon learn as the documentary goes on that rape in Sierra Leone is basically accepted by women and girls as just a part of everyday life in that part of the world. And the men regularly receive absolutely no consequences for their actions, so there's very little to stop or change this from occurring. In the next excerpt, a lady who works in the Rainbow Center, a nurse, talks about the prevalence of the transmission of STDs and HIV among rape victims. The statistic is really staggering.
This is Sister Mafinda.
Nice to meet you. I'm Nick. How often do you see sexually transmitted diseases in girls who've been raped?
90%.
90%? That seems high, especially considering that many girls probably have, you know, only been raped by one person, perhaps not that many times. And, I mean, that, no?
A lot of the girls that come through this Rainbow Center, that incident is what has brought them to the Rainbow Center, but it's not the first time they have been abused.
In Sierra Leone, there's a process or an action known as de-virginating someone. And unfortunately, it comes with a sense of pride, and the perpetrators don't really care how young the child often is that they are committing this act to. Part of the film continues, we come to the local police station in Sierra Leone, and they have a division that actually investigates sexual abuse against women. However, what we see as this part of the film continues is that their quote-unquote investigations are severely lacking in the way that they do business. It's almost like they are just going through the motions and pretty much wasting everyone's time. The story of this part focuses on a young teenager who is raped by a family acquaintance who also happens to be a local pastor in town. Yeah. And unfortunately, as the story unfolds, you know, they come very close to actually pressing charges against this individual, but in the end, the whole thing pretty much falls apart. In the next excerpt, Nicholas is speaking with the young rape victim, and he asks her, in her heart of hearts, if she feels that she did anything wrong to cause this. And she basically replies that, well, no, she doesn't believe she did anything wrong. She states that the family of the perpetrator came and pleaded with her for his release.
to Dadbert House and may lose any further education. And meanwhile, the rapist will get off. It's really hard to find legal remedy to rape when you have cultural attitudes like this, where rape is unfortunate but forgivable, but you're being raped is just an unpardonable sin.
In the next section, we travel to Cambodia with Meg Ryan, and we meet Somali, who cares for girls who have been sold as sex slaves.
My personal mission is to fight against child exploitation, women and children exploitation. I'm the mother and the grandmother of all the suffering girls who have been sex slaves in Cambodia.
In the following excerpt, Meg Ryan speaks with Somali about her work, and she reveals some of the disturbing statistics about how sex slave work has evolved in a negative way in Cambodia.
Somali, not only do you rescue these girls, you have centers where you rehabilitate them, educate them, and that's your life's work.
That is my life. I think I cannot live without that. That is my life because I help them, but they help me. We help each other, I think.
Don't you think the situation is better now in Cambodia, though, than, say, a decade ago?
It's not easy to talk like this because before in my age, like 12, 14, 13, you know, right now you can see my girl. You're going to see 3 years old, I've been sold in the brothel, 5 years old. So the age is going more and more down because if she's 12 or 14, she's too old already.
And you rescue girls from brothel? How does that work? How does that, what happens on the day that you go in and say this, you'll save this one or that one?
They do a raid on a Thai border in a few days. There's a young girl being held in a brothel.
She's 14, so right now we make a file complaint with you to the police.
Do you go alone?
Sometimes I go by my own because it's so dangerous. It's military. So dangerous. You cannot, our team cannot go inside because of the risk of the guy.
Well, you're incredibly brave.
Thank you. We always say we try our best because you love us. We have nothing to give you back. We have no money. We have nothing. We are going to be the good person helping others, helping ourselves to show you that we are survivors. We are from the brothel. We are from the darkness. Because in Cambodia, I think everywhere when you are prostitute, they treat you very badly. So we just want to show the people around the world and the people, you know, like we have also dignity.
In the following excerpt, Somali talks briefly about what happens when she engages in a raid on the brothels in Cambodia.
Somali will periodically stage a raid on a brothel with the help of the anti-trafficking police. That has to start with intelligence about a young girl being kept inside a brothel.
So this girl, she's been, I mean, when I talk to her, I feel that she's been, like,
how old is she?
She told me that she's 14.
She looks very young. She looks very young, too, for that
matter. I know the girl living there is very young.
Somali went into her brothel pretending to have some military connections. She wore army fatigues. And chatted with the girl, she took photos, and then presented that intelligence on, obviously, underage girls being held.
She had been, like, 10, 12 plans a day. If she don't want it, they beat her.
Well, it certainly sounds like she's trafficked.
She's there, like, 3 minutes midnight, 30 years for her.
And the reason that you only work with
money. The girl is very money. So you bring the girl, of course they're not happy with you.
When Somali goes to raid the local brothel on the Thai border, we discover a building that's run by a man and a woman, seem to be a married couple. There are military-type figures around the building with army rifles, and it's a series of rooms that lock with padlocks on the outside. Inside the rooms, they're very small. They have basically a bed and then pictures of young, and I mean young, like under 15, naked girls surrounding all the walls. It's quite disturbing. In the final part of this part of the documentary, Meg and Nicholas and Somali venture out to the remote part of Cambodia where she runs a place known as the Somali Mam Foundation. And it's basically a place for her to bring the girls that she's rescued from brothels and give them an opportunity to be young girls again. She educates them, she clothes them, feeds them, and houses them on the foundation grounds. And it's just an opportunity for them to, get away from the brothel life and get back to something resembling the life of a young girl. In this next excerpt, we hear a young child who is 4 years old sing about her experience of being sold into a brothel. For these girls, singing about their experience seems to be much easier for them to do than to speak about it. At the first part of the song, or throughout the song, the young girl's singing in Khmer, which is the language mostly spoken in Cambodia, but Somali does do translation, so listen carefully for that.
It's often hard for these girls to put their past into words.
She asked who is brave enough to come up and sing their song.
For the Hellenist song, it's a little bit easier. And most of the girls have their own song that they have written to express their story. Other girls know them by heart and they sing together.
Her heart is breaking.
I'm just 4 years old, and they told me the brothel. And I didn't know nothing about the life means, and they destroyed my life. And they beating me, hitting me all the time. They forced me to have sex, like I'm an adult. And I want my mother to come and help me. Where is she? Why she left me alone?
I've never heard a story like that from a little girl. You can't come up with something more beautiful than a young, innocent girl. And it's with that experience on that human being, unspeakably cruel.
In the next part, we travel to Vietnam in the Mekong Delta. Here we are met by Gabrielle Union, who joins Nicholas there, learn about how young girls, due to the extreme poverty in the area, families are often, they have to keep their young girls at home pretty much to take care of the family. And because of that, the girls often are excluded from receiving any kind of an education, which severely limits their, possibilities for any kind of a successful future.
Here they meet a man named John Wood, who started a program called Room to Read,
and it's to help educate young Vietnamese girls who wouldn't have access to this education otherwise. In this segment, excerpt, he talks a little bit about the work he does and its mission.
The core belief of Room to Read is world change starts with educated children. We focus on two core areas. One is literacy, and the other is equal opportunities for girls.
In this segment, we meet a young Vietnamese girl who has to sell lottery tickets. These are sold daily, I guess, in Vietnam, and they don't, it's not like the lottery here where you win millions of dollars, possibly win millions of dollars. I mean, you get very little money for what you buy the ticket for. And I think it's like a daily drawing kind of thing. And this young girl is forced to sell tickets by her father, and if she doesn't sell the tickets, there can often be extreme retribution. I will play the segment. She is speaking in her native tongue, and I will translate what she's saying. She's saying when she sells tickets, she gives the money to her father, and he gives her back approximately 50 cents a day. She says the sales are good, she will sell more, and she can save a little more. But if sales are bad, she's not able to save anything at all. And all the money that she makes, she spends on entertainment and education.
Does your father beat you?
Nichols just asked if she is not able to sell a lot of tickets in a day, will her father beat her? And she responds that, in fact, he does. She says sometimes she tries to hide the fact that she is somewhere else from her father.
Vietnam, but also in America, if they had all the difficulties that you have, they would drop out of school, and they do drop out of school. So what keeps you going? Why do you stay in school?
She says she doesn't want to be selling lottery tickets for the rest of her life.
Is it possible that you and your dad might figure out a way for you to have more money for yourself?
She says she doesn't want to speak to her father. In this next excerpt, Gabrielle Union speaks very candidly with a woman who works with John Wood at Room to Read about her own personal experiences, and they talk together about possible ramifications to the young girl who sells letter tickets. Her name, I believe, is Nee.
It probably just a lot worse than even what she has shared, because she can't control it. I see so much of my own struggle as a, you know, as a teenager, and how education like plays a role. You know, when I was 19 and I left home, and you know, I ended up getting raped on the when I was at work at my after school job, and the thing that I immediately went into was the school, like. You know, when you're raped, it's the absence of control. So the one thing I could control was school. And I just dove into my schoolwork. I became an amazing student. So I can relate to me being so driven in school. And I just wish for girls who have to go through any kind of adversity that they have education as an outlet for healing.
Yeah, sorry, make me worried because me often cry when people come to consult her to talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
So just like you're sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You're sorry. So do you think that me by your experience you think that me is suffering something like you did in the past?
I don't know. We definitely
is physical and emotional abuse, which he admits readily.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will say, like, I cried all the time.
Oh, yay!
The segment ends with John Wood speaking about what he hopes his work will bring, and his own thoughts on the great sadness of the situation currently as it stands.
What I need to do is go back, and I need to tell the world this is what a small amount of money can do. It is a moral failure that 200 million girls in the developing world woke up this morning and didn't go to school. By the time that I die, I would like us to start every sentence with words like, every girl goes to school, every child is literate, every child has access to reading materials, and no child should ever be told you were born in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you didn't get educated. That whole idea just belongs in the dustbin of history.
So this closes part one of my review of Half the Sky. As you've heard thus far, conditions for women and girls in developing countries constitutes a daily struggle just to survive. I apologize that I'm unable to cover in greater depth more of these girls' stories. However, I would encourage everyone listening to view the film or read the book. Both are readily available. I saw the film on Netflix, and I believe you can also view it for free on their website. And the book is available anywhere books are sold, Amazon, and once again on the website. For more information about Half the Sky, the website is, as you might imagine, halftheskymovement.org. That's Half the Sky, MOVEMENT.org. And please come back again on December the 26th, the day after Christmas, for part two of my review. Next week, I'm pleased to announce that my guest will be Teal Scott, the spiritual catalyst. For those unfamiliar, Teal is a remarkable woman with her own tragic past who has become a force for all that is good in the universe. Please join us as we examine some of the spiritual issues encountering the human race today. It's sure to be an enlightening discussion, empowering for all. You're listening to 30 Minutes on Air Amartitio Radio, broadcasted on Blog Talk Radio. You can find us on the web at www.blogtalkradio.com/AirAmartitio. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/AIRAMART. Thank you very much for listening this evening, and good night to you all.
Hello, and welcome to Feed Your Head,